Welcome back to our, I don't even know what episode of Tell It Anyway it is, but we're back. And this week we are taking a break from our one-word thematic storytelling devices of shame and childhood and fear, and we are using the phrase a very long way. And so this week I have with me two tremendous people. First up, we have Greta Schwartz, who is in Brooklyn, New York.
Brooklyn!
And Greta is a graphic designer and is one of the most hilarious people we know, and we never get to see her.
Hi.
So like the whole purpose of this entire podcast has been, let me just talk to people I never get to talk to and have a reason to do it.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the entire reason was just to get me on.
But yes. That's
what I thought I was going to.
Nope.
And we got out.
You are all insulted and are now leaving.
Yep. Gotta go.
And that other voice you hear is Alex Cook. Now, if the name Alex Cook sounds familiar, it is because he has been graciously lending us his music to make this podcast sound much, much better than it has any right to be. And Matt and I have been huge fans of Alex's music for a very long time. But Alex, in his day job, paints murals. So welcome, Alex.
Thank you.
Alex is in Boston under 8,000 feet of snow.
And counting.
And counting. So I thought that this topic, a very long way, would be of interest to the both of you, because I know, Alex, you travel a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Greta, you've gone on some long life journeys yourself, which I guess we're going to hear a little bit about later. But just to make it easy, I thought I would kick it off with a story about a very long way. We have a friend whose name is Ptolemy, and Ptolemy likes to tell how you can tell a bad party before you even walk in the door. And it just has a certain vibe. If you're like walking up to the door, you can feel it before you even cross the threshold. So this is a story about the worst party I've ever been to.
Awesome.
And there were contenders. There were serious contenders for this. So back in late 2007, the Writers Guild went on strike. And my husband, Matt, is a member of the Writers Guild. And so he went on strike. And like a good little wifey, who was also a freelancer, I joined him. And we met a bunch of funny, friendly, awesome writers. And, you know, this thing dragged on for a long time. And of course, on the first day, all the agencies sent guys in tuxedos with catering trays to make sure that all the striking writers were properly attended to. And then on the last day, it was like you're eating crumbs off the ground in the sewer. It devolved quickly. But we happened to meet a great person. It was a guy, and his name is Charlie, and he was just a lovely guy. And then we met his wife, and she was lovely too. And we were like, oh my God, new friends. Because as you both probably know, when you get to a certain age, it's like so much harder to make good friends.
Mm-hmm.
In LA, there's sort of this like mid-30s epidemic where you lose friends like they're being drafted in some sort of league.
Marriage.
Like, yeah, well, marriage, babies, better housing prices. Yay, Florida got the Lorenos and Texas got...
Yeah, exactly. The marriage
leagues. Yeah, the marriage leagues. And you're losing like all these people to better teams. And it's kind of a bummer. And so this nice couple, Charlie and his nice wife, this is not the Charlie that was just on our podcast, by the way, who talked about fears, another Charlie. And they invited us to their Hanukkah party. And the selling point of this party, as Greta, you may know, is that they make really great...
Donuts?
Donuts.
Yeah.
And these donuts, you could just call them Jewish jelly donuts, but they have a name, which is, how would you say it, Greta?
Sufganiyot.
Okay. That is good to know. Matt just flew out of
Jew
his
chair. Jew alert.
Matt just flew out of his chair. So we make the decision that the potential of all these new friends is definitely worth this long drive across town to the West Side.
Even though they're Jewish.
Because we don't take that drive lightly, because it's a very long way in holiday traffic.
Where's this party taking place?
So we're in Hollywood, which is one side of town, and they're on the west side of Los Angeles, which does not seem that great a distance in geographical miles, but oh, in LA traffic, you have to put extra water in the back of the car and make sure you have a spare pizza because you're just not going anywhere. So we get to this party and we're like about to step across the threshold and we feel the waves. Just feel the vibe, and we know, we don't know why, but we just know it's not going to be a good party. The first thing we realize is that our friends come to greet us and they're super nice, but they're kind of stressed out because the problem with making a lot of Jewish jelly donuts is that you have to make them and you make them fresh. And so you're constantly in the kitchen and making them. And that whole idea of like greasing the wheels. Oh, wait, did we just lose Greta?
No.
Okay, your video just went to black. I was like, where did she go? I'm insulting the Sufgan Yacht. She disappeared.
I'm offended by how many times you said Jew.
I know, Jewish. I've said Jewish.
I'm joking.
You can only half be offended at me because I am half Jewish. So like our friends are busy in the kitchen. They're not there to grease the wheels of conversation. And there's something about the layout where this party has an inner couch area and all the close friends, the people who really know these people, are gathered on the inner sofas. And then there's these outer extra sofas where by accident or design or whatever, all the lesser friends are sitting.
Oh,
and of
no.
course, like we are the lesser friends. So there's this like very intense and smart, wonderful conversation going on in the inner circle. And then the outer circle are like, doo-dee-doo. Oh, yes. Hello. And you know, like that moment in a conversation where you feel like you're invited into the conversation and you're welcomed and there's a lot of improv yes anding. And that's sort of the tiny seed from which new friendships grow. This did not happen ever at this party. Every conversation was like a very intense, polite brick wall.
Oh, God.
And it was like as if somehow from the ceiling or the powdered sugar or whatever, all this like awkward dust just like sprinkled over the entire party. And we didn't have any momentum and it just kept sending us back to the outer couch. And again, the hosts aren't there. And we sympathize with this because we had a meatball party once where we didn't know you could make the meatballs ahead of time, really, like a day ahead of time. And so at this whole party, Matt has meatball in his hair and like running around going like, oh, I'm gonna make you feel comfortable. And like dinner is sticking out of his top of his head. And then there was this girl and she was very intense and very forward. And her job was to go around the party and make sure everybody tried the jelly donuts of no particular religious origin. And
it doesn't seem like a hard job.
No, it's not a hard job. But the way right. there was something about the way that she pronounced the word, which was, have you tried the Sufgan Yacht? Have you tried? You should try this Sufgan Yacht. Do you know what a Sufgan Yacht is? And it was just one of those things where like the very word itself became a shield against being involved.
Oh, no.
And now, mind you, all right, this is the part where the half Jewish girl has to prove her Jewish credentials before she can say something really mean. Like my grandmother is a full on Jewish grandma. She used to make matzo balls, little matzo balls that would like float up out of the soup. And her entire love was expressed through food and hugs and little kisses on the cheek. And like she was the Jewish grandmother, right? And like my dad did a whole radio series about Jews in America. And like we have delved into the Jewish cultural history, if not fully the religion. And so with all this in mind, I'm find myself sitting on this couch and wondering like, am I an anti-Semite? Because we're so miserable at this party. And it has a particular cultural feel to it. Have you ever felt this, Greta? Like, has this ever happened to you?
Yeah, because I work in a very religious, Jewish religious community center. And I'm like many times disgusted by some of the things that people say and how they behave. And it's, yeah, and I just walk around. I was like, you're making us look bad. you're bringing us down. And I've thought that. I've looked at people and I've been like, especially in the airport, there's a lot of like loud Jewish families with a million kids at airports. And I looked at them and I was like, you're giving us a bad name. You're what people hate about Jews.
And mind you, every single culture and religion has their own version of these people, right? You can just name every spectrum. It's part of the human experience is that just some people are assholes and it doesn't matter who they are or what they are. But in this particular moment, we were feeling it. And just to prove, this is a little digression, but just to prove to you that this really was the worst party ever, we went to another party. This was years later in Malibu. And when you go to Malibu, man, you got to really want to go to Malibu because it's even farther than the West Side. You better bring sleeping bags. And so we go to this party, and it's another party where we walk in and we realize, like, oh no, this is not good because it's a small apartment. There's like three people on a couch and one child. It's like a whole party just up and vanished because like the whole table was filled with food that looked like it had been attacked by vultures. Like clearly some very intense moments had been had, mm-hmm. but we had not been, and we were really there like 10 minutes late. Couldn't figure out like what was going on. And so we feel immediately uncomfortable. Turns out like maybe some people are down by this pool, which is like way far away, like a long walk down like a development. And we just know like we're doomed here. So Matt goes to cover his uncomfortableness at being at a work party that he was dubious, my work party that he was dubious yeah. about going to anyway, by going to get some sangria. And he like opens the spigot of this big thing that holds sangria and it immediately starts pouring out onto the floor. So he like grabs for the paper towels, but the spigot is still going. And like it's immediate four people just all looking at us chaos. And so I turn off the spigot and I'm like trying to clean it up. I was like, Matt, just go get food. Just go. So he goes and gets the food and I'm cleaning up and I finally get the sangria cleaned up. And in this kitchen, there are these amazing ribs. The ribs are like the highlight of the party, but they're no longer arrayed on a platter because all those ribs have been eaten. They're in the dish in which it was cooked, and there's a knife, and you're supposed to hack off a rib. And let me just say that the next thing I see is Matt Flanagan walking out, holding his wrist.
And, oh, no.
yeah. And holding oh, no. The palm of his hand out to me. And there is blood pouring down his hand. And I was like, it's been 30 seconds since the last time I saw you. So, like, I take the paper towels that I've been using up to clean up the sangria. Meanwhile, like, all four people are just, like, spellbound because we are the big fat disaster that walked into this party. And I just clamp his hand. And the joke is we haven't even seen the host of this party yet. And so we have to go find the host with me like clutching Matt's hand and pulling him along. And he's in shock and shame and all this stuff. We find the host upstairs and we're like, okay, so we need a Band-Aid because Matt has cut his hand. There might still be blood on your ribs. No. And we spilled some sangria. And oh, by the way, maybe we started a fire. It was bad. But all of this is to tell you that that party with the ribs and the bleeding and the fighting on the way to urgent care was not the worst party we've ever been to.
It's hard for me in Boston right now to imagine anything other than glory happening in Malibu.
I know.
I agree.
I know.
It's just Corvettes and the beach and sunsets and girls in bikinis, guys hitting volleyballs. I can't even imagine that being true.
All of that is totally true. All of that is true, except in this one little tiny apartment where Matt is bleeding out onto the floor.
I like to imagine that somewhere there's another podcast where the hosts of that party are telling about the worst party they ever threw with the worst guest that ever showed up. Yeah. Talking about you guys.
And we were there for a grand total of 11 minutes. I'm not kidding. Like it was 11 minutes and there was nothing we could do but leave and go to the hospital.
I mean, when you go to the worst party ever, you don't hang around.
Right. You get all done in 10 minutes and you're out.
Go strong or go home.
And the joke was, is that walking in, we had had like a discussion about what our code word was going to be to leave because we had learned that you needed a code word or else you would get stuck at this party because that's what happened at the Suf Ganyot party, which was that was early in our party going years and we didn't have a code word. So at this party where they're like the smoke is in the thing from the jelly donuts and the latkes and the whole thing, we can't leave. We're just stuck and stuck and stuck. And so finally we leave this party at the Suf Ganyot and we're driving home. We get a text from three of our remaining friends in LA, which they're really the same remaining friends in 2006 that they are now, or 2007. But they're like, come out to this bar. And we do. And as we're sitting there and drinking beers and talking and letting out this like huge pent up social rage that has grown in us from this entire party, like we're starting to heal and we realize I know, we're like, it was such a dramatic like,
pretty dramatic language.
I know. It was that bad. It was like the realization of how far away real friends can feel when you're at a party where there are none.
It's true.
Yeah.
And so in the future, we decided when we're sitting there at the bar with all of our friends that we would always have a code word. And inevitably, that code word has always ended up being Sufganyot.
Awesome.
Because that's easy to work into conversation.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, we have done it. We have done it. And so, but the sad thing is because of this party, these lovely people that we really genuinely liked, we've never really like kept touch with. It was sort of, they had a baby and that's another. And so it just didn't take. That friendship didn't take. So that was my very long way story, which is the two parties we went to all the way across town that turned into a living disaster.
Did you try the donut?
Yes, they were delicious.
Do you think the host of the jelly donut party have any sense that their party is now being described as the worst party ever?
God, I hope not. The joke is that it's such a subjective thing about a party. I actually think that many, many people at that party had a terrific time.
The inner circle.
The inner circle. The people at the inner circle of the couch had a lovely time. They were having a good time. They all knew each other. They felt free to wander in and out of the kitchen and help and do all this stuff. And like, I think there were two very different parties going on. And what we felt when we walked in the door was the lack of inclusiveness that other people would have felt like, here are all my friends. I mean, like, for them, this party was like the focal point of their year. It was their version of our meatball party or Christmas tree ornament party or whatever it is. So, yeah, it's such an interesting shift in perspective, which is this miserable experience we had was probably, to them, a perfectly successful party.
Right.
So that was my very, 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 very long way to learning that you should never go to a party without a password to get out.
Yes.
I'm so glad that I wasn't there.
Seriously, it sounds awful. God, awful.
But you know what? We've been to lots of wonderful parties out here. And as we find that we get older and more crotchety, we definitely lose our tolerance for enduring those kind of things where you just know it's not going to happen. It's like, if I were single, I would describe it as like a bad date. And you're just like, yeah, no, out. You know when these things aren't going to happen. And because we have less and less friends out here, we have to endure less and less parties. So that's good.
That's it's one of the way to look at that. Sure.
It's one of the great things I think about getting older is that you just don't have any sanguine hope of like, oh, well, this might work out. Let's just wait 5 more minutes and see if it works out. You're like, nope.
You can smell the stink and you're out. You're just out.
It was real interesting to think about that, the concept of a very long way. My story does involve travel, but also emotional distance or inner distance or something. When I was 26 years old or so, in the year 2000, I was living in Athens, Georgia, and I was just out of college a few years. And I was thinking about telling the story tonight, I was trying to see through those eyes and remembered how small I felt, how young, how tiny and young. As a prelude to this story, it's important to say that I had done a bunch of bike touring before this. I had ridden my bike from Boston to Buffalo, New York, and then from Boston to Savannah, Georgia, and then a bunch around Europe. I had ridden several thousand miles on my bike, and it was something that I loved and was used to sort of camping in the woods and on the side of the road, and it was a very wonderful kind of adventuring part of my life. Anyway, so this is now a few years after those things have happened, and I was in a pretty dark place emotionally. I was pretty sad, feeling super lonely. I had moved to this new place. I had lived there a couple years, hadn't really made any friends. And, you know, despite my efforts to connect, they were just, it wasn't happening. I did, however, have a job that I loved. I was working for a tiny nonprofit where we would go to schools and community centers in rural Georgia and do anger management training with the kids. It was a program that tried to reach at-risk kids who were either about to go to jail or had just gotten out of jail, and reach them through art, reach them through play, reach them through job skills, and basically sort of anything that we found could work. Twice a week, I think I would go with my boss in his tiny white Mazda 323 down Highway 441 from Athens to Madison, Georgia, which is a 30-mile drive through the country. And we would come to this public housing development and work with these little kids, you know, between the ages of like 5 and 13 or so. And, you know, there's just something so sleepy about rural Georgia. Mm. It's slow, and the weather is gentle, and there's this vine called kudzu that has grown over the whole countryside of Georgia, and it fills the trees and it covers the rooftops, and it's just, you know, growing over fences, and the whole place just has this, at least to my northern sensibilities, this kind of slow and almost forgotten feel, just like a place that nobody's thinking about. And yet here are these people. Anyway, I was in the habit of going to this place twice a week for work. And so I knew this little town of Madison, Georgia. I was feeling so just distant from anything good, from connection. And, you know, I'm a painter, so I often think in images, and the image, one particular image that was coming out of me a lot during this time was images of myself walking, just going, just getting the hell away from everything with a road in front of me that just never was going to end. And I could just walk and have this soothing feeling of just walking between the trees. And I don't have to think of anything except putting one foot in front of the other. Hmm. And it was this dream, this kind of totally impractical dream of escape from all the things that I didn't know how to fix. But one day, I guess I had a week off or something. And when you have a week off but no friends, it's actually kind of a sad thing.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, well, you know, what the hell? I'm going to get on my bike. And I'm going to ride my bike down to the panhandle of Florida, which is about 350 miles. And I'm just going to bike down there. What happens, happens. I'm going to camp on the side of the road. I'm going to visit the beach, and I'm going to turn around and come back.
You know, what happens, happens is Florida's state motto. And it's usually not for the better.
Yep. So I had this little like pinprick of hope in front of me that this week, you know, this could be a real fun adventure. And so I set out on whatever day it was, and I think it was fall. I think it was probably September or October. And I set out down Highway 441, the road that we would drive down to go to Madison. But that road goes all the way, you know, down into South Georgia and pops into Florida. So I started going, and you know, I enjoy biking, so it's feeling good. And then about 20 miles into it, I started to feel like, this isn't fun. Why am I doing this? And I got this like, ugh, like, God damn it, what am I doing? And so I kept going because what the hell else am I going to do? And I arrived in Madison. And, you know, it's like a 30-mile ride. And so I was like, well, let's take a break. And so I took my bike off the road and I went over to the public library. And I parked my bike on the back of the library. And I just kind of farted around for the afternoon. But what ended up happening was I set up my tent in the backyard of the public library and I stayed there for the next 4 days.
Wow.
And didn't go any further. And I just camped in the backyard of the public library, feeling a little bit like the guy from Saturday Night Live who talks about living in a van down on the river.
Down by the river.
But also like a little bit like, this is kind of cool. Like, I live in this alternate universe where nobody knows me. Nobody knows who I am. I can go anywhere in this town and look at anything. And I had that kind of like fly on the wall kind of feeling.
Was it just, I cannot move any further physically, or was it just like, it does not feel right?
It didn't feel right. And rather, what did feel right was, I guess I was more interested in watching life happen in this little town than I was in moving my body through space. So over those few days, I just kind of walked around the town. On Sunday morning, I guess I was there on a Sunday, I was walking around and I saw a church with its doors open, and I walked in and I went to this church service and I, you know, just watched the service. It's sort of all the while delighting that nobody knows that I'm like this weirdo who's biked into town.
living in the back of the library.
And living at the back of the library, like, I mean, a homeless person.
Did anybody like at ever point come out and be like, is that bum from the tent? Get him!
I mean, I lived in terror of that during all the days that I was there, but it never happened. And the big climax of the story and sort of the final delight of being there was there was a high school right across a yard from the library where I was. And over the few days, I would watch the parents drop the kids off. And so I got this big idea that I was going to, like, clean myself up as best I could and go into the, I guess maybe I called beforehand. My idea was that I was going to pretend that I was a writer from a newspaper in Athens and interview the principal of the high school.
Huh.
I guess I did call because I remember speaking to the secretary and saying, you know, this is Alex Cook. I'm a writer from Athens and I'm writing a piece about, you know, public school administration. I'd be interested in interviewing the principal of the school. And thinking, like, this woman is going to laugh and hang up the phone. But she didn't. She sort of said, okay, well, can you do, you know, tomorrow at 11 a.m.? And I said, well, sure.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. So in fact, I did do this. I did kind of, the most hilarious moment was, okay, like, I'm getting out of my tent. That's literally like 200 yards from the principal's office. And I'm like trying to cover the fact that I haven't showered in 3 days because I have been biking and living in this tent, and like make myself look as presentable as possible, and then walk over, you know, straighten up, stand up straight like I'm a real guy and not this like depressed, like pitiful post-college weirdo. And then walk in and interview this principal with all these questions that actually were very fascinating to me. You know, what is it like to build the culture of a school? What are the biggest problems? You know, all just whatever was interesting, and just feeling like I was just putting one over on them. And, you know, that it really felt like crossing a very strange line. Right. I didn't actually lie. I do write. I was a writer from Athens, Georgia. I did write some things. I was writing a piece, but it was obviously not the thing that I presented that I was.
Right.
And I ended up having a very, very interesting, you know, hour long conversation with this principal, shaking his hand, leaving, and then going back to my tent, satisfied. And then the next day I biked home and went back to my life.
It sounded like you were just in desperate need of like human
connection.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you picked, it's so interesting because you could have picked a librarian, right? At the library where you were, you could have picked any person or any of the people that you worked with in that community. But what drew you to the principal?
It was a couple of things. I think the main thing was that I was seeing this kind of like tide, this ebb and flow of the parents dropping their kids off and the kids going in, thinking about their day in the school, thinking about the parents' day in their jobs, and watching the kids go in and out, and just having this feeling of this, there's this life happening that is here in this town. These people are having this, their lives, the only lives they know are living in rural Georgia. It's a life I don't know hardly anything about. It was very attractive to think about being able to just be someone that I wasn't.
Alex Cook from the Tenting Gazette.
Yeah, exactly. Readership 6.
Yeah, my first question is, may I live in your gym?
It would be a step up, sir.
But what was the principal like?
He was affable. It just blew my mind how interested in answering my questions he was.
Right.
I mean, this was a long time ago. I don't remember the actual content of our conversation too much, but I do remember the feeling that he gave off was he absolutely believed that I was going to write something in a public, you know, a newspaper or a journal of some kind that was going to be seen and read by lots of people. Mm. And he spoke to me respectfully and, you know, gave thoughtful answers to my thoughtful questions. The conversation was so substantial and just under this entirely false pretense.
I feel like at some point you're going to be like, and now he's the senator from the state of Georgia. Because I am deeply glad that this whole conversation did not end with you up in a Georgia prison.
Yeah, getting arrested.
But this is probably not your only story about the sustenance of the kindness of strangers, because didn't you bike across the United States?
I never actually biked from coast to coast. I did do a trip that involved lots of hitchhiking, lots of biking, that was from coast to coast, and I have done lots of bicycle tours. People were just generous beyond what people imagine that they would be. You know, total strangers going out of their way to, you know, to feed me, to clothe me, to make sure I had what I needed, to be friends, to feel connected. As much in, actually probably more hitchhiking than in the bike tours, where people just, I think sometimes when it's one-on-one and they kind of know they're never going to see you again, people just open up.
Was there ever a time, Alex, where that trust backfired, where you were scared or threatened or anything like that in hitchhiking?
There were a couple of situations where I really had to think and feel hard and fast about how to handle the situation where I didn't feel safe. You know, the person was doing or saying things that made me realize that I was not in my normal position that I was used to of just, you know, we're going to have a good time. We're going to get there. There was one guy who I was with who was really acting very crazy. Mm. He was saying things that he was just losing his temper. I think I was probably 23 or 24. I was hitchhiking from Albuquerque, New Mexico to Missoula, Montana. This guy picked me up in Wyoming. We had 7 hours to go to Missoula. We had a long drive ahead of us, and this guy started acting absolutely nuts. He told me how many months, weeks, days, and hours ago his wife had died.
Oh.
And would start crying while he was driving. He told me he was on the run from the CIA. You know, it was just not a good thing. And so every once in a while he would sort of get frantic and lose control of himself.
While driving.
Mostly in terms of his temper and what he was hollering. Hmm. And I very quickly realized, like, if I want this to have a good outcome, I have to exert something.
Right.
And it was a strange thing because I was 24 and he was probably 50. But I think it was maybe the first time in my life maybe it was because he was a stranger. In any case, I realized it's my job right here to command him to control himself. It was very strange. It was very strange. And I, when I realized that was what had to happen, I was like, that's insane. He's going to punch me in my face. He's going to stab me. He's going to, you know, you don't command strangers to do anything. But I realized it was kind of like when someone has no structure, the kindest thing to do is to give structure. And so just because I thought the alternative is worse, I tried that. And I said in a very stern voice, you cannot do this. You know, you must control yourself. And he said, oh, okay, thank you.
Wow.
And then he ran you off the road. No.
Amazingly, then, you know, we had a lot of time in this car together. We ended up singing along with the radio together.
Oh.
It was like very sweet. It was really strange and sweet conversation that happened. And every once in a while he would flip out and I would have to tell him, like, you must stop this again. And he would go, oh, okay.
Almost as if you were fulfilling a role that his wife used to fulfill.
Right.
Something. There definitely was that moment of like, oh my God, I'm going to open the door and jump out and do that role like they do in the movies and just like get some cuts on my arms and be like not in the car with that guy anymore. It was hard to hitchhike from Albuquerque to Missoula. I was like, that's hard. And this guy was going to take me there. And I was like, that's precious. I can't I have to work with this. You know, this is what life has given me. I have to go with it.
Well, I wish I had known that for our experience, because I would have said, I command you to stop saying Sufgan Yot and sit down and just talk and talk to us like I'm a person. That's so interesting.
You should try commanding strangers more frequently.
I just settle for commanding Matt. Lazy bones, wake up, little lazy bones, we got work to do. Because you're a long way from home. And you've been playing a fool. I said you're a long way from home. And you've been playing a fool. You better get up, get dressed, get clean, and go to school.
Come on, you can't just spend your life. All right, so a very long way for me made me think of my therapist, who at least every couple months says that to me. She's like, you've come such a long way, which is sweet and like annoying at the same time. But it's sort of that's sort of what those words brought to my head. So I was thinking of when I was young, I was like super shy, but really like joking around and loved comedy. And I remember like one of the first jokes I ever played, I think I was like in kindergarten or first grade, was this thing where you like have a box and you cut a hole in the bottom and you stick your finger through it and you put ketchup around it and you put like a top on it so that when someone else opens up the box, it looks like there's a severed finger in it.
Oh,
which does not go over well in like first grade and kindergarten. I was like doing it to other girls because I couldn't talk to boys, but so like I would do that joke to girls and they would think I was the weirdest, grossest person. I thought it was the funniest thing. And like, I figured out how to do that, how to make it look like a severed finger. I thought was amazing. But no one else found that funny. So that was my first indication of maybe what I find funny. Other people don't. And I was like, maybe I'm going to start keeping some of the things to myself. And also, and April Fool's was like my favorite holiday also as a kid, because it was just like a joke, a day for funniness seemed bizarre to me. So I would like take all my favorite gags and load them into my little red wagon, my flyer wagon.
Wait, literal little red flyer wagon?
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, filled with jokes.
Filled with gags.
It's the best possible thing.
I had a squeezable mustard thing where you squeeze the yellow string came out of it.
And I love it.
Like the rubber melted ice cream that looked like someone was going to step in melted ice cream.
Oh my God, I want that red wagon.
So my little red wagon that I filled with my gags on April Fool's Day. So it was the squeezable mustard, the string flew out of the like a can of peanuts that had some peanuts at the bottom. So it shook, but when you opened it, like the spring of a snake flew out of it.
Yes.
Classic. Which,
all the classics.
Total classics. And my favorite, again, an indication of how weird I was at that age, was the hypodermic needle. But like the needle disappeared into it. So it looked like I was shooting myself. I don't even know where these things came from. I don't remember buying them. I don't remember who gave them to me, but I had them. So I would like walk around the neighborhood pulling my wagon of gags on April Fool's Day.
You're gagging.
This is the best already.
Here's the problem. I'm so shy that I can't approach people. So I don't actually do the gags to anybody. I just walk the wagon around the neighborhood, because the concept of a wagon filled with jokes on April Fool's Day, I think, is enough for me.
Enough for me too.
I can't approach other humans and talk to them to do this gag to them, because it's horrifying, because that finger thing certainly didn't work out. So like I can't, that was enough for me. And I stayed like very quiet and very shy like my whole life, seemingly thinking that I was hilarious on the inside. Like I was convinced I should be on Saturday Night Live. But if anyone who met me in that between then and, you know, college probably thought I was like the quietest, most boring person on the planet. And on the inside, I'm hilarious. I just can't talk.
You're like the ghost haunting the neighborhood carrying your fake throw up. So great.
So one summer that I was in college, I stayed up. I went up to school in Syracuse and I stayed and I got this job, and I was in advertising and I answered an ad in a newspaper for what I thought was an advertising job. Turns out it was door-to-door selling. Oh. And like it was like, for $20, you can get $40 worth of meals at the Red Lobster. Like those things. And like golf packages and meals. And so I just like took it because I needed money. And the first day I showed up at this office, and like I show up at like 8:30 in the morning and I sit down, and then there's like a lot of very young, energetic people. And they're like, you can't sit. I was like, why? They're like, as soon as you're in this office, you're on, and the energy's on. And then, like, the boss would take us into the back office, and he'd be like, here are the rules for today. Everyone has to stand. There's never sitting. You stand in a circle, and they talk about all the ideas and all the selling we're going to do today. And don't forget to be happy, and everything's great. I was, like, as angry and, like, in college as I've ever been. And I was, like, quiet and didn't know how to express myself and didn't know what emotions were. And I was fucking mess. So, like, I gave it a shot. I went one day and I went door to door smiling and trying to be friendly and talking to strangers, which is like all the things I hate.
Terrifying.
And like tried this, and I came back to the office and I was like miserable, and I wanted to sit down. You still couldn't sit. Everyone was so happy and all the people who worked there was smiling and everything's great. I went home and I actually punched a hole in my wall because I was so pent up anger. Like, I didn't know what to deal with it. And I was like, I know what I really want to be doing is not smiling and being happy and being friendly, but I don't know how to do it. So I like punched a wall.
I know that. I've been there. Mine was a hairbrush into a glass window.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Because you don't like know what to do with yourself.
It's
pent up and it's, you're right. Anyway, remember I said I go to therapy? Anyway. So
I do too.
So I went back the next day to give it another shot. Spent the whole day miserable. And I was like, I can't keep doing this. I'm so miserable. I hate everybody around. Every time they smile, I hate them more. And every time they talk about like selling more, I hate them more. And I couldn't deal with this. So it's the end of the second day and everyone's standing around in the office talking about their selling and stuff. And again, everyone's standing, smiling, and we start telling jokes. And everyone's telling nice jokes and friendly jokes. And I just like, again, the anger inside me is, you know, just volatile. And I don't know what to do with it. So I decided to like really just say what was on my mind. Mm. It's the one joke I know. I don't know why it's the only one that stayed in my head. But I knew it was going to be offensive. And I didn't care. I didn't care what they thought about me. I had to let it out. And I just looked at them and I said, and I apologize in advance, people. But I just looked at them and I said, guys, I have a joke. Huh. What's better than fucking a 4-year-old? And they stare at me and I go, nothing.
Oh my walked God. Out.
And I walked out of the office and I was so happy. I was like so proud of myself. And I was like, that's what I wanted to say. I find it funny because it's so horrible and I don't care
that
none of them think it's funny and they're all going to think I'm crazy. And it doesn't, I don't know. It was like so liberating to me.
It sounds like that reaction to a bunch of super happy people and you just want to punch a hole in their wall.
Yeah. I was like, this is the worst thing I can say right now. And for once I just like said it. I was like, this is, fuck you guys.
Oh my God.
It's amazing to me that in the fabric of the world that happened somewhere. Yeah. Somewhere. I was alive when that happened. I didn't know that it happened, but it happened.
As if we, at some point, we all felt in our 20s the ripple of
there was,
that
there
moment.
Was a wrinkle. There was a wrinkle in that force. Time. That up.
A wrinkle in time rippling out from Syracuse, New York, love all the way that. Down to Athens, Georgia, wherever the hell I was. Yeah. In my late 20s. Oh my God. So, A, was there that little girl inside of you with your gag wagon just raised her hands in victory and cried out, I've done it?
I did. I like skipped out of the office. I like skipped out of there, drove back, and I felt so content. Not just like this content where you're like, yeah, like maybe I figured something out. I mean, that's not the joke you want to figure stuff out on, I guess. But like, right. I just felt like, I don't know. I felt good about it.
After that, did you feel like you took something from that? I mean, were you different after? Did you feel more powerful? Did you feel more free?
I felt freer because I think one of the reasons that shyness and being so afraid to say things are these consequences that we make up in our heads. And like my fear of failure is just so huge. And then like you do that and you're like, oh, it's not a problem. Your consequences are whatever we want them to be. Yeah, that was like a big deal for me to be like, I can say something offensive. If it's people I don't care about, then I don't care what their reactions are. I don't need them to like me.
It's interestingly similar to that hitchhiking thing where like you had a very intimate moment with those people.
Oh, yeah.
But it was enabled because they were people you were not going to see again.
Exactly. Yeah, I was like, I'm leaving here, so I'm blowing this place up, and I'm walking, like, you know, and like the superhero walks away with everything blowing up behind him. That's what that was me.
And I like to think that in the shattered silence after you left, all as one, they all looked at each other and sat down. that your ultimate victory was just to make them all sit down and be
I broke them all.
So how has your life path taken you? Has your life path taken you any further towards comedy?
Well, I perform improv regularly now.
Yeah.
I do storytelling fairly regularly. I mean, doing improv is the exact opposite of everything that makes me comfortable. Mm-hmm. It's not planned. It's in front of a lot of people. They show up to laugh. If they don't laugh, they're not happy about that. It's my worst nightmare. But I started on a fair amount of drugs doing it just to get through it. I had a conversation.
And by drugs, are we talking about crack or
pills? Just Percocets, Vicodins.
Got it.
Anything that sort of took away the anxiety and made me be like, okay, I'm going to get on stage and not worry about it. And actually, one of the things that helped was our friend Ptolemy, already referenced in this podcast. I was like panicking. Just in class, they would maybe call my name and I'd start shaking uncontrollably. And I spoke to him about it. And he said that when you're nervous and scared, you hold your breath and your body's not getting enough oxygen. Your shaking is a physiological response to not having enough oxygen.
Hmm.
And that to me was like, oh, if I breathe, I'm not shaking because I'm scared. I'm shaking because it's just oxygen. Like that made it better. And actually now I breathe a lot and I'm very conscious of that. And I'm like getting used to failing and not being afraid of it. And like, yeah, now I'm like no pills and nothing. And I just get up there. I don't even get nervous. It's amazing. It's really, I've come a very long way.
Oh.
And scene. And
blackout.
But I have those gag gifts now because I would totally use them.
I know. Yeah, I was wondering what happened to your wagon of gags.
I have no idea. But
can you please write a memoir and call it the gag wagon?
Yeah.
Gag wagon. To be honest, I have thought about like the movie of my life would open up with like a little girl pulling a wagon, but like she's so sad.
I just want to own that image for a moment.
Me too. I'm not going to make a painting of that image.
Right? Oh. What a beautiful thing. So I don't know why I did, but I grew up and developed this intense regulatory agency inside my brain, similar probably to you, that prevented me from ever saying anything offensive or rude or even braggartly, like being a braggart or being not completely humble. And it's so, Matt gets so mad at me. Like there was a point, funny enough, with the meatball party where we were going to send out an invitation that had like some totally innocuous balls joke, right? I mean, you basically do a meatball party to make ball jokes.
Sure.
And in my mind, like we were sending this out and I was like, somebody's going to get offended and then it's going to be this and we can't send that joke. And Matt, as a comedian and someone who's made his living on comedy, was so angry at me. And so like our whole experience over the last couple of years has been like anytime my brain shuts the floodgates on a joke or on a something I'm going to say, like I definitely get like commanded to make the joke.
Yeah. Just well, commanded. That's like the death of comedy is like trying to be too precious with it. And it's just like, never going to do it. You're going to ruin it. And just it's very hard for me to let go of trying to be like perfect and like make sure everything's right and the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah. All right. So, all right, we're going to do this. This is our game. I command us to play one little game.
Okay.
Which is, I'm going to use that phrase now forever. It's like, Matt, I command you to do the dishes. So get ready.
It works for God. So
I sense it wearing off quickly.
Matt, hello. So I want us all to go around and just say something that we normally wouldn't say to the internet, to an uncontrolled, unknowable audience. Just one thing you wouldn't normally say. Alex?
Well, that's actually a hard question.
Yeah.
Something.
Oh, does Greta have one? Greta, do you have one? Greta's going to go first. Greta's letting you off the hook. I saw her face. She has one.
I have one because I've decided, like, I do this to myself where I challenge myself because I'm afraid to do things. Like, I hide behind fear. I come up with challenges that so that I have to do them, which makes my life difficult, but it's sort of the only way I can propel myself to do things that scare me.
Yeah.
So stupid. When is this going to go up?
She's like, I have to write like three things to three people ahead of time. Before.
Oh, wait, I've never had a boyfriend before. I now have a boyfriend because I'm so shy. I've never been in an actual relationship before and I'm 41, but now I have a boyfriend and I want to tell him I love him and I've never said that before. So now it's out there.
Oh.
And now I can't take it back. So I have to be out there. By the time this goes up, I have to have done something about that.
She broke the game.
The gag wagon. The gag wagon lives.
The gag wagon. Guided by Greta's bravery, I will tell you, I stepped on the scale this morning. I'm 5'3". I stepped on the scale this morning. I weighed 200 pounds. And I almost fell off the scale and like fell down. And I was just like, oh, come on. Because in previous podcasts, you have heard all about my canoeing and my rippedness and all this stuff. And somehow all that healthy, good biking behavior and walking behavior and all that stuff is gone away. It's gone away. So that's my thing. I would never, ever tell the internet.
Good.
Yeah.
Fuck it.
Yeah, fuck it. At least I'm not 201. We've come like such a long way. We've done from bad parties to tent reporters to gag wagons to
gag wagon.
A very, very long way.
Confession of love. I only have one more thing, which is I command you both to give me your social security and mother's maiden name.
Hell no.
That seems fine. What could possibly go wrong?
Oh man, well thank you both for being on. This is amazing.
I've created a monster.
I know. I just love it. I'm gonna get I command you tattooed across like every surface of our house so that everywhere Matt looks it will just say I command you.
Sorry guys, I've got to go home wash the dishes. I don't know why, for some reason I did.
You may have noticed in all the uproar about Greta's declaration of love and my declaration of donuts, we forgot to get Alex's answer about a thing he'd never tell on the internet. So if you want to know more, you're just going to have to walk over and knock on his tent and ask. The cool thing is you can learn so much more about Alex Cook by checking out his music at alexcook.bandcamp.com. And you really should check out Greta Schwartz on Twitter at gsthrowlikegirl. If you're lucky enough to be in New York, you can go see her perform improv and sketch. And if you're lucky, maybe she'll bring out the gag wagon. And finally, a personal message to our old friend Charlie, who long ago was kind enough to invite us to a Hanukkah party. Charlie, I hope you never hear this podcast, but if you do, let's all go get donuts and catch up. But maybe this time on the East Side.